This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. If you know about Boston, then you know something about the name Ortiz. And we're not talking about the Red Sox slugger Big Pappy. That's David Ortiz. We're talking about Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, the chief federal law enforcement officer here in Massachusetts.
Carmen Ortiz was in the news a lot last year. She led the government's successful corruption case against former House Speaker Sal DeMasi. She's preparing the prosecution of James Whitey Bulger. And she won a controversial terrorism conviction against Tariq Mahana of Sudbury. And for that, and for her up-by-the-bootstraps personal story, the Boston Globe magazine named her Bostonian of the Year.
Appointed by President Obama in 2009, Carmen Ortiz is Boston's first female and first Hispanic U.S. attorney. In a moment, she'll be with us to talk about some of the big cases she's handled. But first, Suzanne Althoff, editor of the Globe Sunday magazine, joins us. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello, thanks.
Good to have you. Tell us why the Globe picked Carmen Ortiz as Bostonian of the Year.
She was a wonderful person for us to choose. Each year when we do Bostonian of the Year, this is actually the eighth year that we've done it, we look for someone who has been a part of really big stories in the year. And as you've just mentioned, Whitey Bulger, Sal DeMasi, whenever there was a big story in Boston, very often Carmen Ortiz was part of it. She has a focus on rooting out corruption, rooting out white-collar crime. To us, she spoke to a lot of the mood of the country, of this desire to do the right thing, to undo what's wrong in our country.
Interesting. Suzanne, can you reveal anything about the behind-the-scenes process of this choice? For instance, who was her competition this year?
Well, her competition, she has runners-up that were in Sunday's Globe magazine. There was the Bruins goalie Tim Thomas. There was a lot of people in our discussion room. In the fall, we begin our hand-wrestling matches. Who is going to be the Bostonian of the Year? Some people said Tim Thomas should do it. There's a woman, Angelica Guerrero, in our issue who was part of the tornadoes in Springfield, and she showed an amazing act of bravery to save her daughter's life. She put her in a bathtub and placed her body on top of her daughter. Angelica Guerrero died herself in this tornado. There was a lot of competition, but in the end, we're so pleased with Carmen Ortiz as our choice.
And remind us who some of the more recent Bostonians of the Year were. Who have they been?
Yes. So now this is interesting. If you go back one year, in 2010, it was Scott Brown. We recognized him for his historic win and for inspiring a legion of long shot candidates. But the year before that, in 2009, it was Elizabeth Warren.
How interesting. Huh.
Yes. Right. So if they end up facing off against each other, that will be very interesting for us to watch. Elizabeth Warren at the time was overseeing that $700 billion bank bailout, and we appreciated how she was sticking up for the middle class and making sure that taxpayer money was put to good use.
All right, Suzanne. Well, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Suzanne Althoff. She's editor of the Globe Sunday magazine, talking to us about U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, this year's Bostonian of the Year. And joining us right now in the studio is Carmen Ortiz. She's been the U.S. attorney in Boston since 2009. And welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
And congratulations for that honor that we just heard Suzanne talking about. You're in some pretty good company. The Bruins goalie, for heaven's sake.
I know. Unbelievable.
Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation with Carmen Ortiz, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Carmen Ortiz, I'd love to start a little bit about your life story. It's impressive where you come from. You grew up in New York City, the daughter of parents who came from Puerto Rico. They had little education, little money, didn't speak much English. What was your child like, and how did it sort of set you up for where you are now?
Well, I'm the oldest of five children, and I was raised in a family, in a household that believed that it was important to work hard, and through hard work and through focus and attention to education, that I could do better for myself, that I could have much more than what my parents had.
And you did. You made it to college and then on to George Washington University Law on a scholarship. What attracted you to the law?
I think initially it was the ability to do trial work and be a litigator, to have the opportunity to stand before a group of people and persuade them that an individual was either innocent of a crime that he had been charged or that they were guilty. It wasn't clear if I was interested more in defense work or prosecutorial work, but I was interested in being able to investigate cases and putting a case together and to help people in trouble, whether from the side of a prosecutor in terms of representing the government and representing victims' interests, or as a defense attorney where you represent defendants' rights.
Mm. Now, your first internship, and I read this from the Boston Globe magazine, at the Justice Department back in 1980, you land in the middle of the Abscam investigation as an intern, right? And just for people that might not remember that, this was a case in which the FBI set up a sting operation that eventually nabbed seven members of Congress who were found guilty of accepting bribes in exchange for legislative favors. How did that case influence your view of government corruption and lead to where you are today?
Well, first of all, it was very challenging in terms of the work that was done, and it was very novel at that time for the government to do these sting operations. But to have the focus on individuals who have been elected to represent the people and utilize their positions really to enhance their own interest for their own benefit, I thought that was just really despicable in many ways. But I also think that, you know, and they were tough cases to make at the time, so it was a tremendous challenge. And I thought that, you know, when people elect someone to represent them, at a minimum, they deserve individuals that are going to act on behalf of the public's interest, not their own personal interest. And I felt like I was at the heart at the very beginning stages of doing legal research, understanding how the cases have been put together. And so it was a great place to be at the time because, you know, this is what was critically important.
So I'd love Carmen Ortiz to talk a little bit about your priorities as U.S. attorney now. The Boston Globe gives you credit for some of the big high-profile convictions that occurred last year. Sal DeMasi, Chuck Turner, Diane Wilkerson. We should also note that those investigations were begun by your predecessor, Michael Sullivan. What are your priorities? What's the mark that Carmen Ortiz wants to leave on the U.S. Attorney's Office in Massachusetts?
Well, I think that there's no question that I want to continue in that steed and do more work in the white-collar crime arena, and not just in terms of political corruption, which is critically important. And our hope is that we continue to do investigations that focus not just in the Boston area, but really throughout the state to rid it of corruption, but also to focus on financial white-collar crime and to continue to enhance our efforts in the healthcare fraud arena.
Mm. Well, let's talk about the white-collar crime, particularly given what the country has been through leading up to the financial collapse of 2008. Some have criticized the Justice Department for not being aggressive enough on this. Your response to that is that we still haven't seen high-profile prosecutions for those who contributed to what was very close to a complete meltdown of this economy.
Well, I totally agree with you. Very serious crimes, if they occurred. I think that the key thing to realize is that the door hasn't closed on that chapter yet. And so these investigations are very difficult. Sometimes they take a tremendous amount of time to do and put together. But they're very difficult also because individuals that are at the heart of these crimes sometimes insulate themselves, you know, commit them with people that they know, with friends, do it through a number of different intermediaries. And so it's very difficult to get the sufficient evidence that you need to prove these cases beyond a reasonable doubt. But I can tell you with no doubt whatsoever that the Department of Justice, as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office, has really done everything that it can to focus its investigative resources on these kinds of cases and, with the use of the FBI as well. And, you know, I didn't mention it before, but of uppermost importance is always our efforts in national security. And so that continues always to be a top priority.
And we're going to talk about a couple of those cases, or one at least. But sticking with white-collar crime, can you point to a case or two that you're taking on right now in this field?
Well, we recently did a takedown of different brokers and lawyers and other individuals that were involved in a scam involving penny stock. And so they were this is in the financial market arena. We're also doing other work that's really in an investigative phase that I'm really not allowed or privy to talk about.
An investigative phase, you can't say anything about it. I mean, related to the collapse of 2008 or not?
Just related to financial fraud in general, quite frankly.
We're talking to Carmen Ortiz. She's the U.S. Attorney for the state of Massachusetts, and you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Isabella, who's calling from Weston. Hi, Isabella.
Hello to both of you. Carmen, my name is Isabella Jancourts, and I'm a lawyer in Weston. And while I congratulate you on a lot of the work that you've done, I'm extremely disturbed by the Tariq Mahana case. Most of the people that I am friendly with cannot understand why he was prosecuted. And my question to you is, how was the decision made to go after this young man? And I guess number two is, why was all that footage played in the courtroom of 9/11 when, you know, he was a child when that happened? Would you talk about that case a little bit, please?
Isabella, thanks for bringing that up. The Tariq Mahana case, of course, controversial, civil libertarians very concerned about it. But Carmen Ortiz, please respond to Isabella.
Yes, I will. And I could see where certain individuals, especially if you're not privy of all the specific details of that case, that you would see it as perhaps an infringement on civil liberties, that we violated someone's First Amendment rights. But I can assure you that that is certainly not our intent and not our goal in these cases. And in that particular case, I can't really explain as to what led us to it, because that then involves investigative steps that were taken that I'm not at liberty to discuss. But what I will say is that from our perspective, when we receive information regarding an individual's not just conversation, not just speech in terms of how they feel about this country, how they feel about Al-Qaeda and what harm they want to bring to American soldiers, but when they take steps to act upon that speech, and when they show the intent that their mission is to join with Al-Qaeda and to support Al-Qaeda's mission in harming American soldiers and others, then that will lead to the type of prosecution that you saw. The footage and the kind of evidence that was exhibited at the trial, the evidence that we used came from search warrants, came from undercover operation that was obtained, statements of the defendant himself, and actions that he and his friends at the time, who all were plotting with him, took. And so when we learn of an individual or individuals who are intent on harming American soldiers or other Americans in this country or overseas, we then conduct an undercover operation or an investigation to determine whether or not there's any validity to those threats, to the intentions that they're discussing, or whether it's just talk. And in this case, in terms of Mr. Mahana taking a trip to Yemen, in terms of translating documents with the intent and the motive
but Carmen
to
Ortiz,
recruit
individuals. If I may, let me just jump in here, because I mean, this gets to Isabella's point and question, and of course it's part of a critique that civil libertarians have made. He did travel to Yemen, but he never managed to get terrorist training. There's a theory about his intent to coordinate with terrorists, but there's no evidence that he did coordinate with terrorists. So was he ever really a threat? Because that's the question that seems to trouble civil libertarians the most.
We really believe that he was a threat. And the fact that he wasn't fully successful at the steps that he had taken doesn't mean that he wouldn't have been successful in future steps. Mm. So in many ways, we've been able, I genuinely believe, to prevent a crime, a certain kind of crime in terms of physical harm coming to people before it happened. You know, if you think about the Fort Hood matter, think about that case where prior to annihilating his co-soldiers, in that case, the defendant was just talking about taking steps and about his hatred and his hostility, you know, towards
No, I understand. And obviously,
and
if you compare it to that awful event at Fort Hood, and you can make a case that we prevented that, then I applaud you. But I guess I'm just worried, or I'm asking sort of on the behalf of Isabella and the critics, if we're not moving perilously close to that point where we are going to be prosecuting people for what they're reading, for what they're saying, for what we think they're thinking. And that seems to be very, very scary.
But I guess from all of the evidence in this case, it wasn't that this individual was just saying and thinking. He had taken steps. He was interested in taking steps. And in fact, a lot of the statements that he made to his cohorts at the time was that he just didn't want to be sitting by and saying and affirming his belief and support for Al-Qaeda. He wanted to take action. He wanted to do certain things to make his support of Al-Qaeda more viable. And the bottom line is that those defenses were presented to a jury, and the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that he had committed the charges that he had been charged with. So he certainly had the opportunity to present, you know, the defenses, and the jury found on all of the evidence that we had proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, let me ask you about what is without doubt the most high-profile case that you're handling, and that's the case against James Whitey Bulger, who was finally caught last year after 16 years on the run. Now, I recognize you're probably not going to be able to say a lot about this as you prepare a prosecution, but can I ask you this? Are we going to have a trial in 2012?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but this is a very, you know, the one thing I can say is this case will go through the same procedures that other criminal cases go through. And right now it's in the discovery phase. Mm. So there's a lot of evidence. It'll be an extensive trial. The defense has to be given an opportunity to review all that evidence. Then there has to be the phase of pretrial motions and pretrial litigation. And then it'll be scheduled for trial. So I would hope, and I would love to see it happen in 2012. I'm just not really sure. It depends on, you know, the ability of both sides to be ready to move forward. But we certainly will make every effort. We've provided all of the discovery at this phase to the defense. Now it's a matter of time of them reviewing it and then moving forward to the pretrial litigation.
Well, as you know, some people have raised this concern. They're afraid that because of his health concerns, James Whitey Bulger's health issues, he might die before he goes to trial. That would deprive the victims of seeing him actually found guilty of his alleged crimes. So with that in mind, why not speed this up and, for instance, let him be tried in California where he could where he would be tried on the weapons charges because of all those automatic weapons that were found in his house? Slam dunk case, 30 years in jail. You could still proceed with your case, but why not do something like that to speed this up?
We actually don't think it would really speed it up. And I think those matters would have their own sources of delay in terms of getting indicted, in terms of going through discovery. It appears that it would be quicker. Mm. But these cases have already been charged. They're pending. All of the evidence has already been turned over to the defendant. And I think because of his age, we want to take as many steps as possible to see that justice is done, especially for the victims in this case.
So is there some point that you want to make about the importance of holding on to the case here rather than, for instance, letting it be tried in California on the weapons?
You know, the defendant has basically had been a fugitive for over 16 years. And finally, he's come into our custody. And so we're going to do everything possible to get these cases tried, to give the opportunity for the victims to see the process played out and hopefully to see justice done.
Carmen Ortiz, we have a caller on the line. Rachel is calling from Westwood. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I just wanted to say I read the article, and I think what an excellent choice and what a great example for our young people. I'm reading a lot lately in the press about, you know, younger people saying, and a lot of people in the Occupy Boston movement, well, we can't succeed anymore just by going to college and getting a job. It's not possible to succeed in America. And I think that you're a great example of someone who is a child of immigrants who succeeded.
Rachel, thank you very much for that call.
Yeah,
Carmen,
thank
is there
you.
Something you want to say to Rachel just in terms of what was given to you as a child that allowed you to succeed? Because it is a fairly remarkable story about your life.
You know, I think, and this is a great opportunity because I do want to recognize some people that actually weren't recognized in the article that are very, very responsible for my being able to be here today. And clearly, in addition to my parents and my parents giving me a lot of love and support as I grew up, my family, my brothers, my sisters especially, who live in Massachusetts, were there for me, especially when my first husband died. My family and my friends have always been there for me. And, you know, when I talk to young kids now, I always say, you know, you can't pick what family you're born into, for better or for worse, but you can certainly choose who to surround yourself with. And I do want to say that I give a special thanks also to my husband right now, Tom Dolan, who was incredibly supportive and encouraged me to apply to be U.S. attorney and gave me a lot of confidence in doing so. And then once I got the job, and as I have it now, helps me with tremendous support in terms of juggling all I have to do in terms of the job, my daughters, my home, and life in general. And so I always tell young kids, you know, surround yourself with people who will support you, who will believe in you, who will encourage you, especially when the hard times come up, when you face certain hardships. And, you know, try to believe in yourself. And also don't be afraid to take risks.
That's Carmen Ortiz. She's the U.S. attorney here in Massachusetts. She was named Bostonian of the Year by the Boston Globe, and you can see the piece in the Boston Globe magazine. We have a link to it at radioboston.org. Carmen Ortiz, thanks so much for coming in today and talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been great.
Stay with us. Coming up, our Common Health segment offers a new twist on dieting. The message, be good to yourself. And later in the show, Anita Hill on her new book, Her Family and the Legacy of the Clarence Thomas hearings. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.